This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is about to get easier to evict people in Massachusetts. During COVID, renters have had state and federal moratoria on evictions protecting them. So no legal evictions. That is until the state's moratorium expired in October. But even then, people have also been protected by this federal moratorium, sort of a second, larger protective umbrella. The thing is, that's set to expire on Saturday. Now, since the state moratorium expired last October, landlords have filed thousands of eviction cases in courts. So now those cases could proceed after Saturday, after the federal moratorium is lifted, for any renter who isn't actively applying for rental assistance. And that could be a lot of people. Is that confusing? Yes. So here to help us understand what is happening, what the stakes are for families, what the stakes are for our economy, we have two guests. Rachel Heller is the CEO of the Citizens Housing and Planning Association, and Doug Quattrocci is executive director of the organization Mass Landlords. Rachel, welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here again.
And Doug, welcome back to you too.
Thank you, Tiziana. Good to be here. And hello, Rachel.
Hi, Doug.
All right. So I have a question, but before I start, Rachel, is that a fair description that we just gave to listeners about what's being lifted, what has been lifted, and who is going to be at risk after Saturday?
It is a fair description. The one headline I want to add is that there is a lot of money available and no one should be evicted right now for non-payment of rent.
Okay, so let's pick up on that last sentence you just said, Rachel. No one should be evicted right now for failure to pay rent, basically. I want to start there with the two of you. Do we have an agreed upon first principle in the Commonwealth right now, which is that the goal is to avoid evictions if at all possible? Doug, is that everyone's goal right now?
Of course. Yeah. Landlords don't want to lose customers. So we don't want to have to put anyone through the stress and trauma of an eviction because we lose the ability to provide housing because of that. So, yeah, we want to avoid all evictions.
And Rachel, your goal also, correct?
Absolutely. We do not want to see people evicted and are doing everything possible to advocate for resources, make sure that there are organizations that can help people, you know, in every community in the state.
Okay, so now there's one more explainy kind of thing that I want to put on the table before we talk further. So we talked about the fact that the state moratorium was lifted back in October. But since then, in the spring, state lawmakers passed a sort of protection, which basically says if you are a tenant who might be facing eviction, but you are applying for some kind of rental relief, then you are protected from that eviction going through. Is that accurate, Doug?
Yeah, if you're being evicted for non-payment. So it doesn't protect you if you've been terminated no fault. For instance, the landlord intends to renovate and they're just not renewing, and it doesn't protect you if there are lease violations. But yeah, if there's any kind of non-payment involved, and that's why the case is being brought, then your case is paused while that application for rental assistance is being processed.
Okay, so Rachel, that means if you're the other two, right, lease violation or the landlord just doesn't want to have a tenant anymore, after Saturday, those evictions can go through, correct?
Those evictions can go through. I would say that there are still resources available for people to help them find other places to move.
Okay, so now let's start talking resources. I feel like we really had to kind of comb out what was going on and understand it, but let's start talking about the resources. Now, and Rachel, I'll come back to you, and let's start with that last thing you just said. What are the resources available to people who may need assistance finding some other place to live?
Well, the best place anybody can go when they need help with housing is their local Housing Consumer Education Center. So in Boston, that's Metro Housing Boston. This is the organization that administers all of the rental assistance programs that we're talking about and can also help with housing, with finding another apartment or home.
Okay, and then what are some other steps people can take? And let's stay on this needing a new place to live.
So in terms of conducting a housing search or actually accessing resources to help them with first and last month's rent and moving?
Let's do that one. accessing resources for first and last, those costs that are associated with obtaining a new place to live.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the great things about Massachusetts is that we do have a lot of excellent programs in place. And one program that has been in place for exactly this kind of situation and to prevent a family from going into homelessness is our program called RAFT, Residential Assistance for Families in Transition. Now, RAFT has become the program that people are going to for help through the pandemic. The program has changed during the pandemic, but the base of that program is still there. The legislature has provided funding for it, and it is there to help people who are in danger of losing their home, need to find another home. And so again, accessing it through an organization like Metro Housing Boston, if you're in the Boston area, is a great way to get help.
And that is real financial assistance, correct, Rachel?
Yes, that is real financial assistance.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So, Doug, what is the RAFT experience from the landlord's point of view?
Well, it's not great. For instance, a lot of landlords want to be able to help their renters get rental assistance because a lot of us, if we're impacted by the pandemic, we have too much else going on to be able to deal with the paperwork to get rental assistance. So if we happened to lease up in a landlord that owns 20 units or fewer in Massachusetts, the landlord can help us apply. But if we happen to lease up with a bigger landlord, currently it's not possible for the landlord to help you by applying for you.
Doug, I'm just going to interrupt you for a second. What does lease up mean when you
What we're trying to get is landlords to actually apply for rental assistance. I probably shouldn't have said lease up, but the landlord is able to apply for rental assistance totally on behalf of a renter and continue a tenancy, even if the renter can't do anything other than just sign permission.
Okay.
So what we're trying to do is help our renters get access to the assistance because that's how we can get paid. But there's this synthetic distinction where if you rent from a large landlord, that landlord's not allowed to help you apply for rental assistance to the extent of doing the application for you. So it's just a little bit of Massachusetts is definitely leading the nation. We're one of the top 10 states consistently in the Census Household Pulse Survey in terms of helping people to afford rent. But there's a lot of strange decisions in the program that landlords don't understand. And landlords have to wait is the primary message here. In some cases, we got a landlord in Gardner who's been working through the process for 8 months. And it sounds impossible. How could it possibly be going on that long? But there are reasons why you get stuck in these loops and you just can't get out of them.
All right. So, Rachel, I'm going to come back to you in a minute. But first, Doug, I want to stay with you on one more thing here. I could imagine that there would be tenants who would be very uncomfortable with paperwork at all beyond what is absolutely necessary and with going through a landlord, for example, if they have undocumented status, for example, going through a landlord to give information to file for this rental assistance. Do we see that? And are there other resources available, or are there other things that landlords can do to connect such tenants with assistance?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there. That is a major issue that we are seeing. And I'll give an example. In May of this year, we asked the Department of Housing and Community Development, how many rental assistance applications did you close out for being incomplete because the renter didn't want to give their social security or acknowledge that they didn't have one because the renter didn't want to list how many kids they have because the renter may have a disability that prevented them from completing the detailed narrative required in this 13-page application, now it's down to 11 pages. And they closed out 5,453 cases in May, according to their public records response to us. That's 5,400 households that started to ask for help, but gave up because they didn't want to have to disclose their situation. They don't want to risk ICE getting wind of their not having a social and showing up. They don't want to list the kids that maybe the landlord doesn't know about because they're in some unlawful housing that should have a lead certificate. There's just a whole lot of problems in housing, and the rental application is kind of exposing a lot of those. And by our estimate, probably half of all the people who've applied since October of last year have not been able to get the rental assistance they asked for because of some paperwork burden.
So, Rachel, what do they do then?
Well, actually, I think this speaks very much to a need that we do have, and that's to work through more community-based organizations. This is actually happening around the state. We have examples like La Collaborativa in Chelsea, where they are working with people to find help, to apply for the help. And, you know, again, talking about Metro Housing Boston, just because we're talking, you know, we're in the Boston area, Metro Housing Boston is actually working with six different local community-based organizations. These are trusted networks, places where a person will go and ask for help. And then there's somebody there who can help them, who can help them with the application, understand what's needed, understand that immigration status is not even a question in the application. And I think it's really important that we invest more in local community-based organizations and give them more resources to be able to expand their capacity to meet the increasing need.
And Rachel, inform listeners, especially those who may be listening with this deadline looming over them on Saturday and worried, what types of financial assistance and what kind of orders of magnitude are we talking about for a given household?
The amount of assistance that's available now is very deep. There is actually not a limit on what a household could get. So a household who needs help, needs to pay the back rent through the entire pandemic, can get that covered. There's even stipends going forward at this point. Like Doug said, Massachusetts has been leading the nation in getting these federal rental assistance dollars out. Right now, the state has been awarded over $760 million. About $200 million of those dollars has been spent. There are plenty more dollars available for anyone who is having trouble paying the rent right now.
So what's really striking me in talking to the two of you, we often have these conversations where we've really got landlords pitted on one side, tenants pitted on another. The two of you share an objective. You're being very collaborative. You're showing how the rental assistance can serve all parties involved. Are there other win-win solutions that are possible and that we need right now? And how do we get there? Just briefly, Doug.
Sure. I think the number one thing that we could be working on would be to bring the housing safety net to the level of the employment safety net. And even though we all experienced a lot of problems with the unemployment insurance process back when the pandemic first hit, the basic idea is employers have to report on a regular basis that they've hired someone within 30 days of hiring, so that if that person loses their job, they can access unemployment assistance. And we don't have anything like that in housing. It would be really helpful if landlords could say, hey, I started a tenancy here. Here's the address. Here are the tenants. Here's their application. So that if anything happens to them, the state already has, or the regional administrator already has, a database to go and look at and say, okay, yep, this is a real person. They were reported 8 months ago. They're eligible for rental assistance within a week because basically all the paperwork's done.
How about you, Rachel? First, do you agree with that? And in a sentence, what else?
Well, I think that what really needs to be done, we have a few things, and we have some great opportunities right now with more federal resources that have come to Massachusetts, the ARPA dollars, the Rescue Plan Act. So some of our top asks out of that is fully supporting the governor's proposal, which is all about creating more affordable housing, which is ultimately the answer, but also funding right to counsel. So what we find is when a lot of people, most, it's well over 90% of people are going to court to fight an eviction, they don't have representation. And so we, through the Eviction Diversion Initiative, there is a pilot right now where people can get legal representation. That needs to be a standard. And then again, providing more funds for community-based organizations. And then I think record sealing is a really important thing to think about, because when evictions are filed, it doesn't mean that the household is going to be evicted. In fact, that might be a point of time where they get the financial help they need. However, they do still have this mark on their record, and that can follow them when they do look for apartments in the future.
Okay. All right. And Rachel, you've given us some resources that we're putting on our website, correct?
That's right. Thank you.
Okay. So our website, folks, is radioboston.org. We'll have some resources there. That's Rachel Heller. She is the CEO of the Citizens Housing and Planning Association. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Doug Quattrocci, Executive Director of the organization Mass Landlords. Doug, thanks to you as well.
Tiziana, thanks so much.
Let's go now to New Bedford, where Herman Melville set Moby Dick and where Frederick Douglass escaped from slavery dressed as a mariner. Today, it has the most valuable commercial fishing port in the world. But for years now, it has also had a shrinking newspaper of record, the Standard Times. The paper once had almost 60 full-time staff, but has fewer than 15 today, according to the Boston Business Journal. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp bought the paper in 2007, and since it has changed hands between large media conglomerates several times. Stephen Taylor, a former Boston Globe executive, teamed up with a group of other local investors to try to save it.
The fundamental premise of a substantial fourth estate in New Bedford was shrinking drastically. And our founders and we want to see if we can do something about bringing that back.
Taylor and friends tried to buy the Standard Times back from its current owner, Gannett. When they were turned down, they started over, founding a new nonprofit newsroom, the New Bedford Light. We caught up with Taylor recently and with Barbara Rossner, the Light's editor, about this new venture. And Bobby began by telling us what makes New Bedford so special.
New Bedford is a particularly interesting place. It's rich history as the capital of the whaling industry and then of the textile industry. It's where Herman Melville set Moby Dick. It's where Frederick Douglass escaped as a slave, came to New Bedford, learned to preach here, first registered to vote here. I mean, it's just got this incredible history and then waves and waves of immigration, which continue now. And I think it's just a fascinating place. I mean, every place I've ever worked has been fascinating, but New Bedford has some elements that are particularly fertile for the kind of coverage that we are attempting to provide. The in-depth investigative type story, and really important to us is the arts and culture coverage, which is our way of getting into all the many, many pockets of New Bedford's diverse culture.
So, Steve, tell me a little more about these particular types of stories, subject areas that are ripe for your coverage in New Bedford, and maybe one that you feel hasn't been covered enough.
Oh, I think the list is long, and the editors would know, too. I came to know New Bedford and Buzzards Bay and this area by water. I know it very, very well, in fact, by water. And so issues of the cleanup of Buzzards Bay and the environment, one of our founders was a former mayor who had a lot to do with getting that cleanup done. The environmental issues that are going to have to be confronted, like any waterfront city, with sea level rise and climate change, but also part of the solution is going to be an offshore wind. And there's a delicate dance between the offshore wind necessity and the fishing industry, which is a critical, biggest part of New Bedford's past and substantial part of its future. And so covering all of those various angles as they unfold is going to be really important. And that doesn't even begin to get to the political and educational and cultural social services scene. So we're starting with the cultural, as Bobby just described, and some deep explanatory and investigative and data-driven stories about things in New Bedford that people wouldn't know about without us.
Bobby, is there an example of a story in maybe the recent history of New Bedford? You can go back a little further if you want to. Story of wrongdoing or accountability that would not have been exposed without robust local news. To bring home why this fourth estate presence is so important.
Well, rather than the investigative area or malfeasance, it's really more basic than that. We were getting off the ground and thinking about this and what our mission is and what our vision is as COVID was ravaging the city. And I did not see a lot of coverage of COVID. I didn't know what was going on, how many people had died, for example. And one of the first things we did, and it took us a couple of months to get the data, was to find out who died in New Bedford from COVID. And it was more than 400 people. And we went and we talked to those people. And it was amazing, the stories that came through. And when we analyzed the data, we found an occupational cluster, that there was a cluster of retired textile industry workers who appeared to have been particularly vulnerable to COVID because of long-time respiratory issues that were related to their work. I mean, the city didn't know where it was in terms of COVID. And that was just a basic thing that we wanted to bring to the table to say, okay, this is what's happened in this past year and a half. And it wouldn't have happened if we hadn't had the resources and the commitment and the support incredible support we have from the community to really dig in that into that and get the data and then mine that data for the storytelling that I think will really be part of the city's history.
Steve, with that kind of urgency in mind, let's talk a little bit about resources and how this works. It's nonprofit, but that doesn't mean it doesn't need revenue. Of course it does. You're not selling ads. It's free. How to stay financially viable in the long run? And any concern about that you relying on sources that you then have to report on?
Well, I think the answer to the latter case is no, because I think the sophisticated people who want to sponsor us realize that straightforward, hard-hitting coverage comes with the territory, whether they're involved or not. And we would have to just not take funds from somebody who felt otherwise. But there's a significant amount of foundation money out in the country, some of whom have mission statements that are pretty much on the center line of what we're trying to do. There's a very substantial number of people in New Bedford and in the immediately surrounding communities who care very deeply about this project, some of whom have real capacity, and we've already benefited from some great generosity. But we had 287 gifts and counting from people for as little as $5 or $10 or $25 or $7.50 a month. And it was really great to see. Bobby's team has only been publishing we're not even at the end of our sixth week yet. But every time something new comes out, we get a burst of gifts, electronic gifts. And one of my biggest problems as the kind of 1.5-person business office right now is keeping up with the thank you letters. That's a really good problem to have. But we're automating some of that.
It does sound like a good problem to have. It does make me want to just push one more time, Bobby, on the editorial wall. I mean, you've got, and maybe the answer is this is no different than people buying a paper, right? They're giving you money for stories in your paper or they're making contributions. But there does seem to be a sort of causality or, you know, here that Steve's talking about. Are you satisfied that you've got a firm editorial wall when you're relying on donations?
Very, very important for the community to understand. And I think that and to be educated really about what it means to be an independent newsroom. What does that really mean? Well, that means, and what do we mean when we say without fear of favor? It means that we are disinterested. We're not beholden to anybody. Same, you know, the wall between the newsroom and advertisers in a for-profit business is there. And there are always attempts to breach it. And I think there will be attempts to breach the wall in a nonprofit. But that's up to the newsroom and to Steve and our board to keep that wall in place. And I think that the more we explain it and explain why and how important it is for us to be a neutral arbiter and not to be doing any favors and not to be afraid of offending any particular group, including our own board members, I think the more they respect what we're doing and the more they understand what it means to be an independent organization. And I think we've made it very clear. We've made it very clear on our website. We've made it very clear in every conversation that we have with funders and potential funders. And I think Steve's right. I think that they understand it, but we need to be vigilant all the time, obviously, and just be prepared to stand our ground and explain why there is this firewall between money and content.
Do you think your model, nonprofit, digital, deep in certain kinds of stories, community supported, is that the future of local journalism? And are you optimistic about the future of local journalism, the two of you?
Well, I could make a comment on that. I spent some time after I retired early from the Globe doing a little teaching at Yale's Business School on how to pay for journalism in a digital future. And I do think the answer is to some degree size dependent. The bigger places, particularly if they're technically sophisticated, can have data sets big enough to do very sophisticated predictive analytics. And that's different than clickbait. But at any rate, they can figure out ways to make real money in a digital environment. Very small places, if you were simply trying to survive on pure advertising, it's very hard to beat out the big guns of Google and Facebook and others for very efficient ways of advertising. And paywalls leave out some of the community who can't afford it. So I definitely feel at the lower level that the nonprofit pure 501c3 public charity approach is perhaps the best approach. But it varies by size, and places the size, let's say, of Boston or Philadelphia are probably somewhere in the middle. But for us and our size, our founders thought very long and hard about several different models, including a public benefit corporation, and came to the conclusion that this was the right way to do it. And I wouldn't have joined if I didn't agree with that. I think it is for our size. And so far, we're off to a good start, but we can't sit on our laurels. We've still got to raise money, and that will happen more easily with great content.
Bobby, as we close here.
I would just add that.
Go ahead.
I think anybody who thinks that there is an answer to this question isn't being completely honest. I think this is an adventure. I think it's an experiment. I think that things in the media world are changing so quickly. I don't know what the landscape's going to be a few years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now. I don't know how we will have to evolve and adapt. I just know that change is inevitable. It's breathtaking. It's speeding up. We're trying this. We're very optimistic. We're very committed to it. We think it can work, but we've got to constantly be ready to shift as needs require us to. And, I think there are all kinds of things that are going to happen in the next 5 or 10 years that we can't even imagine in terms of communications.
So, Bobby, I'm going to end with you, and I'm going to read you a bit of a poem written by Matt DeMello. He grew up in New Bedford, wrote the poem to commemorate the light's founding. The poem's called "For Every Lighthouse There Is a Watchman." The snow has begun to melt. I can see the sand dunes at last. Summer is almost here, and you, dear lighthouse, is all I need to see what I have written. Here in the lantern room where I make it happen, on paper, with a number 2 pencil, I can hear the sound of late-night ideas. I can see the boats asleep in the water. Bobby, is the lantern room the newsroom, and are you the watchman?
Well, I don't know if I'm the watchman. I think the newsroom is the lantern, and I think that our mission is to illuminate our community and look at it in its totality, and especially to shine a light where it's most needed.
That was Barbara Rossner, founding editor of the New Bedford Light, and Stephen Taylor, its publisher. For more of their in-depth reporting on New Bedford, you can visit their website, newbedfordlight.org. New CDC guidelines recommend that vaccinated people should still wear a mask indoors in areas with high or substantial transmission of COVID-19. That includes Boston, Barnstable County, Bristol County, to name a few. Governor Baker has said previously that he will not be reinstating a statewide mask mandate, but cities like Provincetown have reinstated theirs after an uptick in cases in the Commonwealth. Earlier today, Health and Human Services Secretary Mary Lou Sutters told WBZ-TV that there would be additional guidance from the governor in the days to come. These are confusing times. They're times in flux, and with that comes anxiety about what's going to happen next. Governor Baker is at an event right now, is holding a press conference, taking questions about the response to the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, and WBUR political correspondent Callum Borchers has been following the governor all along, waiting for the governor to start speaking now, but is taking some time to join us and discuss the state of the state. Hey, Callum, welcome.
Hey there, Tiziana. Great to be back.
So this is where we are now, Callum. It used to be that the news might break a few minutes before the show or an hour before the show, and now we're waiting for it to break during the show. But I do want to start by what we think we know about what we might hear from the governor in just a few minutes.
Yeah, I think that what we will hear, based on reporting from our Steve Brown, who is tailing the governor today, is that he is still reviewing the CDC's guidance and is going to make an announcement in a few days. So that sounds as though he will not make any changes to the state's policy today. But it leaves everybody kind of in the state of limbo that you mentioned at the top, Tiziana.
Okay, so while we are limboing, let's talk about where we are right now. Remind us all what the current state mask guidelines and COVID restrictions are.
Sure. I mean, the state lifted its mask advisory for fully vaccinated people before Memorial Day, as many folks may remember. Unvaccinated people are still asked to mask up. And of course, businesses have their own rules. So you may have the experience of walking into an establishment that wants you to mask up regardless of whether you have been vaccinated or not. And of course, if you're on public transit, you're still supposed to wear a mask. So there is some variation. But basically, most of the state, if you're fully vaccinated, you're able to walk around freely. And what I think is interesting, Tiziana, is, you know, remember that the original date that the state was going to lift this mask advisory was on August 1st, which is coming up in just a few days now. But it was pushed up to May 29th because things were going so well in the spring. And so now, you know, you can't help but wonder if the governor had stuck to August 1st, whether we would just be looking at an extension of the mask advisory. But since the governor eased restrictions earlier than he planned to, it may be harder to ask people to take a step backward now.
Yeah, Callum, I had forgotten about that original target date of August 1st. All right, so let's do the compare and contrast, because then the CDC changed course yesterday. Compare and contrast what the CDC is now saying with what the official policy in the Commonwealth is.
Right. There is some conflict. I mean, in most parts of the state, the CDC is still saying that indoor masking is not necessary for vaccinated people. So that is consistent with the state's policy. But the new CDC guidance does conflict with the states in five counties, which, as you mentioned earlier, qualify as substantial or high transmission areas. And you named a couple of them. The five altogether are Barnstable County, Bristol County, Dukes County, Nantucket County, and critically for many of our listeners, Suffolk County, which of course includes Boston and many surrounding communities. Although, you know, it just shows you, though, that the lines between these counties are highly permeable. No greater example than our own station, Tisiata, which straddles the Boston-Brookline line. So it is right on the line between Suffolk County, where you're supposed to now wear a mask regardless of vaccination status, and Norfolk County, where the transmission rate is lower and you are, at least for now, not being asked by the CDC to mask up if you are fully vaccinated. But people are walking back and forth across that line all the time.
All right. So I want to turn our attention fully nationally now. Congress has reinstated their mask mandate in House offices and chambers. The Biden administration is now requiring journalists to wear masks at press briefings in the White House. We know the Department of Veterans Affairs has made statements about required vaccinations for staff there. Are we expecting, Callum, and are there rumblings about more sweeping mandates like a federal mask mandate at the federal level?
Well, you know, I'm thinking back to right after the inauguration when the president signed an order that required masks on federal property in places like airports and train stations. I think we could be headed toward a return to something like that. But a wholesale federal mask mandate might be a last resort for this president. And I'm thinking of some of the pushback that you're getting already just to the revised mask guidance in Congress. I mean, we heard yesterday, for example, from the House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, who's a Republican. He said, quote, "Make no mistake, the threat of bringing back masks is not a decision based on science, but a decision conjured up by liberal government officials who want to continue to live in a perpetual pandemic state." So pretty forceful rejection there. And of course, it's not true that this is not based on science. This is, in fact, the advice of the attending physician in Congress. But that's the kind of pushback that you get. And meanwhile, the rhetoric on the other side from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who's a Democrat, her retort to Kevin McCarthy was, "He's such a moron." So that's the kind of rhetoric that we have going back and forth in Congress right now. It's a highly charged political environment.
All right. So speaking of Congress, before we let you go, we're going to speak just momentarily with Senator Elizabeth Warren. Anything specific that you're going to be listening for in that conversation?
Well, you know, shortly before we came on air, a bipartisan group of senators said that they have reached a deal on an infrastructure bill. We've been waiting for this for a while, and the president said he's optimistic about it. We don't have a lot of details on it yet, Tiziana, so maybe the senator will be good enough to fill us in and make a little news on our air.
Oh, do let's ask her. That's WBUR political correspondent Callum Borchers. Callum, thank you.
Always glad to be with you.
And we are going to turn now to Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who joins us for our first check-in since this past winter. There is a lot to cover. COVID, student debt, infrastructure. So, Senator Warren, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
So, Senator, I almost have to chuckle because we had a whole list of things we were going to talk to you about today, and the one not on the list was actually infrastructure. But just last hour, so Republican negotiators announced that they'd reached a deal with Democrats on key elements of a $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill. I want to ask you, have you been briefed on the contours of that agreement? And if so, are you on board with it?
So we will be having a vote tonight that will let the Senate move forward to debate the bill on the floor. We've gotten enough of the contours that I think it makes sense to bring this bill to the floor. But understand, bringing it to the floor does not mean that all the details are worked out. So I'll give you an example. Yesterday, there was still a big fight over whether there'd be enough money in it for transit. And you know that's something that's really important to us in Massachusetts. And there was a lot of pushback from the Republicans that money should go into highways, but less into transit. And, I can't make sense of that in a world where we are facing a climate crisis and where so many of our transit systems are so old. So as of this afternoon, we are in a good place on transit. A lot of money going into it, the right proportion going forward. So that's one piece that we think is locked in, and I will be working hard to make sure that we stay on top of it over the next couple of days before we come to a final vote. But another piece, broadband, when we talk about general outlines, right now the whole section just says broadband. So there's a lot that has to be filled in under that. But it's at least a basis to begin a debate on the floor of the Senate.
So you would vote to begin that debate tonight, Senator?
I would vote to begin the debate.
Okay. And then, so the debate begins, and I know it's a complicated process, but I'm also aware, and we've talked a lot on the show here before, about the linking of this bill with this larger $3.5 trillion spending package that the president also wants. Do you anticipate mm-hmm. that linkage will remain, and will the outcome of the debate that hopefully is not right the word, that may begin tonight, would affect that in any way?
Oh, as I have always described this bill, there is really just one package. Now, it comes in different parts and may take multiple votes. Part of it is a narrow part, narrow relatively speaking, that is roads and bridges and I hope something good on broadband. But the rest of it is child care and home and community-based care. It's about the expansion of Medicare, and it is about putting real resources into fighting back against the climate crisis. It has always been one idea, one package that we're moving forward. One half of this or portion of this does not go forward without the rest of it.
Okay, so then let's come back to what you called the narrower package, which is this transportation mm-hmm. piece. At this point, do you anticipate that that's going to make it over the hurdle and become law? I know you have said that not everything is defined yet.
Yeah, and that's the problem. We really can't say until, the jello has to set up here, so that you know what this thing looks like before we do the next round of votes. And understand, this is a 60-vote threshold. I don't want to get too much in the weeds, but I want everyone to understand the challenge here. It will be a 60-vote threshold for this thing to come out and make it to the next level on its votes. So this is about trying to hold a lot of people together who have a lot of challenges, but here's the good news. I think it's fair to say on this package that the Democrats are generally rowing in the same direction. we are trying to build an infrastructure package that works for all of our states, that works for all of our people.
All right, so I'm going to shift gears a little bit here, Senator. Earlier here on this show, we talked about the end of the CDC's eviction moratorium. You have got your eye on the student debt moratorium, which is due to end on September 30th. Democratic legislators held a press conference yesterday calling for President Biden to extend the pause on student loan payments, that part, until at least March 31st of next year. But you also renewed your call for the president to cancel up to $50,000 in student loan debt. He has in the past favored $10,000 potentially. Have you and the president talked recently face-to-face about this? And where are you with him on steps forward?
So I'm not going to talk about personal conversations because I want to keep having personal conversations. But what I can say is that I am hopeful. And here's why. Canceling $50,000 of student loan debt is good for a lot of people in this country, and it is good for this economy. Keep in mind that 40% of the people who are carrying student loan debt do not have a college diploma. So they are managing to pay student loan debt or ask to pay student loan debt on what you make as a high school grad. More than half of all people who are in trouble on their student loans are people of color. They are disproportionately hurt because they borrow more money to go to school, they borrow more money while they're in school, and they have a harder time paying it off when they get out of school. This is an economic justice issue. This is a racial justice issue. And I believe that the President of the United States, who clearly has the power to cancel student loan debt, will pick up the pen and cancel that debt.
Okay, so I want to just keep it clean for our listeners. There's two pieces to this. There's postponing loan payments, and then there's canceling student
That's
debt.
That's the temporary piece. Right. And I'm all for the temporary piece because, let's face it, the temporary piece, this moratorium, is going to run out in just over 2 weeks. And people are not ready. We've seen data now that about two-thirds of borrowers are saying, I can't do this. You know, people who've lost their jobs, people who don't have child care and can't get back to work full time are saying, I can't do this. Our economy is coming out of this pandemic, and it's looking good, but it's also fragile. We don't need to hit debtors with what, for many of them, it would be the equivalent of another rent payment, another car payment, how much they spend on groceries every month. Not good for those debtors, and certainly not good for our economy.
Okay.
So the short-term part is give us a pause until next spring, but the more important part is the permanent part. Cancel $50,000 in student loan debt. Senator Schumer, Congresswoman Presley, and I are fighting our hearts out for this.
Okay, so one of the things for people to understand is rather than congressional action on this, the push has been for the president to take executive action. I want to come back to this forgiving student loans, and I want to play you some sound from Speaker Pelosi speaking to reporters during her weekly news briefing this afternoon.
People think that the president of the United States has the power for debt forgiveness. He does not. He can postpone, he can delay, but he does not have that power. That has to be an act of Congress.
And she went on to question the wisdom of the debt forgiveness, saying in part, quote, suppose your child just decided they, at this time, do not want to go to college, but you're paying taxes to forgive somebody else's obligations. You may not be happy about that, end of quote. So that is one part about who can do it and another part about political will. And I want to get your reactions to both of those things.
Sure. There's no doubt that the President of the United States can cancel student loan debt. And you know how I know that? Because President Obama did it, President Trump did it, and President Biden has done it. He has canceled billions of dollars of student loan debt for people in different circumstances, and he has canceled, not delayed, canceled interest on all outstanding student loans every single month since he got into office.
So is the speaker just wrong?
That is estimated to be about $5 billion. There's just no doubt. The President of the United States can cancel student loan debt. He's done it before. I just want him to do it for $50,000 of student loan debt. He's done it for all 43 million Americans who have outstanding student loan debt. It's already happened. The speaker also talked about as she put it, the politics of doing it. You know, I think of it this way. I pay my taxes, so do other people, and I pay my taxes that in part support highways in South Dakota. I haven't driven on a highway in South Dakota, and I may never drive on a highway in South Dakota, but I help pay for the interstate highway system. I do that, why? Because that system overall is good for all Americans. It's good to have a system that works and people can get goods and services to market. People can get to their jobs everywhere in America. The same is true about student loan debt. Even if someone listening to us has no student loan debt, they should want to see us cancel student loan debt for about 35 million Americans. And here's why. The Fed has already identified that people who have student loan debt are much less likely now to start their own businesses. That's holding back entrepreneurship in America. They are much less likely to be able to buy homes. That's holding back wealth building in America. The consequences of student loan debt are certainly felt by the people who are crushed by that student loan debt, but they are also felt throughout this economy. Canceling student loan debt, good for individuals, good to help close the racial wealth gap, and good for our economy overall.
All right, so Senator, I want to be mindful. Our show is going to be over in about 60 seconds, so super tight.
Okay.
You suggested Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins to be the U.S.
Yes.
Attorney. That nomination has happened. Reactions and any concern about losing a reformer here in like three sentences?
Sure. I wish we had two Rachels. One who could stay in the current job and one who could come over and be U.S. attorney. She is someone who ran on her values, and then when she got in office, she delivered. And it turns out when people studied what she did in terms of changing the decisions for who would be charged for minor crimes, what Rachel did helped people across Boston. And it is impressive. I want to see that same kind of courage and creativity when she's U.S. attorney. She's going to be terrific in this job.
That is Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Senator, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.